This is a debate that has been going on since Alzheimer's disease was described. Is Alzheimer's disease part of the aging process? You know, if anybody lives long enough, will they get Alzheimer's disease? It's true, people over 85, as many as half of them, it's been estimated in some studies, might develop Alzheimer's disease. So if that's the case, if at least half of the population, some segment of the population is going to develop Alzheimer's disease, is that normal aging? You know, if more than half of the kids in school are going to get a cold, is a cold part of normal human biology? So these are philosophical issues, but the real practical question is whether studying the normal biology of aging is going to help us either prevent or treat this disease. That's the real objective. In my view, the objective to live longer for its own sake is not one that should be pursued. I think what we should pursue, and plus I don't believe it can be pursued, no matter what the elongation and lifespan of a worm is. I'm not convinced you can significantly extend the natural lifespan of a human at this point in our scientific history. I think one does have the ability to enable that lifespan to occur in the absence of certain diseases like type 2 diabetes and Alzheimer's disease, or to delay the onset of those diseases. I think that is within the practical realm of medical technology, and that should be the goal. I think to pursue prolongation of lifespan for its own sake is, in my view, a narcissistic goal, which is, number one, I don't believe it's practical, and I also believe that it detracts from the more important goals of the healthy lifespan, preventing disease, increasing the economic and productivity of the aging population and of society as a whole. So that's my point of view on it. I know there are different points of view, and that's where I think this question of the biology of aging versus the biology of age-related diseases comes in. So getting back to the question of whether studying the biology of aging can inform you about the biology of age-related diseases, I think it can, because the major risk factor for a number of these disorders, type 2 diabetes and Alzheimer's disease and so forth, is the aging of the brain or these other organ systems like the pancreas. Yet there is absolutely no understanding right now of why aging is a risk factor for these diseases. A very simple question. The number one risk factor for Alzheimer's disease, more than any other gene that's been written about in the newspapers, is simply the brain getting old. Why is that? What is it about the old brain that makes it more vulnerable? If we understood that, if we understood that basic process, what is the difference between a young brain and an old brain? You don't ever see Alzheimer's disease in a 25-year-old brain, except in the case of very rare mutations. We might be able to model pharmaceutical therapeutic interventions on that knowledge.
A lay audience member, or even me, might say at that point, your little aside there, the in brackets, except in the case of rare mutations, isn't that where you would look to see whether the mutation in fact was the cause, or is that just a...
Well, that's an interesting question, because the assumption has been in the field that these mutations are giving us important information about the cause of the sporadic disease that occurs in 70, 80-year-old individuals. This sporadic late-onset old age-related disease, which accounts for the majority of cases, it's not clear that the etiology of it is really the same as these genetic causes that cause onset of disease at age 40. Now, the appearance of some of the pathology, namely the changes in the brain cells that occur in both cases, can be very similar. But there are actually differences in the clinical progression, some of the symptomatology, and there's a debate as to whether Alzheimer's disease is one disease or many pathological entities. So this genetic analysis of Alzheimer's disease has been very successful in the sense that a number of genes have been identified which have provided biological information about a certain hypothesis, the amyloid hypothesis. But it's debatable how much it has informed us about the old age form of the disease. There's no real compelling conceptual framework for the start of that. How does that get started? We just don't know after all of this genetic analysis. So some people are beginning to question whether these genetic causes of the disease, although they might short-circuit the process that occurs with aging and cause it to begin very early, do not really tell us about the earliest events that cause the disease in older people.
I should mention, by the way, that this is a continuing conversation at the Epigenetics Workshop in Santa Barbara, and this is Bruce Yankner from Harvard Medical School. What would you describe your trade as? Molecular geneticist, pathologist?
I would say molecular neuroscientist.
Yeah, right. So molecular neuroscientist, but in the Department of Pathology at Harvard Medical
School. Well, actually, I have joint appointments in the Department of Pathology and Neurology.
Okay, great. How much of the information that gets to a general audience about what to do to lengthen your lifespan or to make your lifespan better, how much of that do you actually believe in, endorse, follow?
About 1% of it.
Do you take resveratrol? Do you do calorie restriction? Do you take hormones and so on and so forth? How many of those things that are out there on the Oprah shelf?
I run, and I try to restrict my intake of saturated fat, and I try to eat a lot of fish.
Okay, so the omega-3s, the omega-6s, that seems something that you would that you approve of, or at least willing to try.
Yeah, based on the number of studies that have been done. In the case of omega-3s, there are a number of epidemiologic studies which suggest that they improve cardiovascular health. That's not proven in terms of brain function, but there is work in animal models of Alzheimer's disease to suggest that those agents may be efficacious as well. So the studies in humans that have been done, together with the studies in animals, I think are starting to make a case for omega-3 fatty acids. And certainly the case for cutting down on saturated fat, having a good diet, is strong at this point. The case for most of the vitamins and supplements is much weaker. And although there are often intriguing results in mouse studies or in other animal models, it's unclear whether that will pan out in humans. And people have to be very careful about those issues. There are many pharmaceutical agents that look great in mice and turn out to have toxic effects when used in humans, and that's very difficult to anticipate. So caveat emptor, you hear something about a mouse study and you go to the health food store and you get that supplement. It's unclear what's going to happen to you if you keep taking that for a long time. The difference between a supplement or a dietary intervention and a pharmaceutical is actually most pharmaceuticals, many of them, are carefully monitored by a physician some aspect of medical care, whereas a supplement, you are monitoring it yourself, which is basically a very subjective, non-objective process.
Let's go back to the point you made earlier about your expectations of what reasonably could be done at this point. And this is a chapter on death from a book called 13 Things That Don't Make Sense by Michael Brooks, which is out there right now. And he's mentioning the a position statement that Leonard Hayflick issued in 2002 and also later in 2004, in the journal Gerontology, Hayflick opened an article with the blunt statement, quote, "No intervention will slow, stop, or reverse the aging process in humans." Was that sort of what you were saying, or is that a little bit more definitive than you'd like to be associated with?
Well, there are different levels of considering that. First of all, a statement like that is made in the absence of clear knowledge. Obviously, Leonard Hayflick had no proof of what he was saying, and it's probable that that comment was made for dramatic effect. I don't have any definitive evidence that Hayflick had one way or another. So in the absence of that, I really can't draw such a judgment. It would be premature for me to. I have to say that with our current state of medical knowledge, we do not yet have evidence for that in humans.
My point in reading that was that some people would take that as being a gauntlet thrown down and say, no, this is an engineering problem, we can fix it, and by a series of stages we can live to a considerably longer than we do at this point.
I think that's unclear. I mean, it is interesting that there are families which have a longer lifespan than many others, in which there's clustering of centenarians and extreme longevity, suggesting that there are genetic factors that may influence, and that may be a co-inheritance of a number of positive genes, or the lack of inheritance of many genes that predispose to disease, probably both. So, you know, from a genetic standpoint, there is evidence of the ability of some individuals or families to live longer than others. But to say at this point that we can pharmaceutically increase human lifespan, other than preventing disease that would prematurely terminate it, there's just no evidence for it.
And your point was that, in a sense, that was that sort of a plan would be, in your view, given the other problems that are immediate that have to be dealt with, that that's almost an indulgence.
Yes, exactly. I don't think it really has any point. I think basically we should use the biology of aging as a mechanism for understanding the diseases and the scourges of old age, Alzheimer's, coronary disease, diabetes, and so on, not as some sort of pipe dream to live until 110 and, stay on this planet as long as we can. I mean, theoretically speaking, even if we could do that, would that be a good thing? Think of what it would do to the resources in society. I think it would create enormous social upheaval. You know, there are limited resources. The population is exploding in parts of the world. If you increase the lifespan that substantially, what would it do to the younger generations in terms of the allocation of resources? There are not unlimited resources on this planet, as we well know. We're rapidly exhausting the resources on this planet and drastically altering the climate and other aspects of the environment that we live in. So I think that, you know, the simple answer to your question is that is an indulgence, and in my view, a pointless one, because the technology just isn't there right now.
All right, so you're now in charge of National Institutes of Health. Where would your priorities be, given the kind of things we've been talking about at these meetings? I mean, what can be done in terms of the biology of aging? Where would you encourage people to put their research dollars?
I would encourage an approach that tries to understand the normal biology of aging, that those aspects which are similar between different cell types, as well as those that differentiate different cell types in the aging process, and the intersection of that normal biology with pathological processes. Alzheimer's disease, coronary disease, loss of muscle mass, osteoporosis, where you lose bone mass. How does the normal biology of bone cells or nerve cells or heart cells, as they age, how does that transition in some people from a normal cell to an abnormal cell and cause disability? I think that intersection is key to understanding those diseases. So in summary, I think the normal biology of aging is critical to tackling these diseases for which aging is the major risk factor. But to approach it from the orientation of extending lifespan for its own sake is, in my view, misguided.
Given an increasing lifespan, given an increasing aging population, then the subject that you're studying and have been studying for some time now, Alzheimer's, is sadly a growing problem, right?
Yes, the incidence is increasing for reasons that are unclear.
For reasons that are unclear?
Yes.
Meaning?
So it's the incidence of Alzheimer's disease has been increasing now for quite a few years, and it will, as we progress through the 21st century, it's predicted to continue to increase based on current trends, and we have no understanding of why that is. One would think if it were a purely genetic issue that there should be a constant prevalence that would not be showing this, what we call vectorial increase. My own view is that there are environmental, possibly epigenetic issues that reflect the interface of brain aging with the environment that are not well understood at this point that are playing a role.
But what would that mean?
Well, it would mean that if we could understand the interface of the brain and environment as we age, as part of the normal aging process, that we could possibly intervene to slow down the process, or even prevent it, although that's really...
I'm sorry, I wasn't clear, but when you're saying the environment, what are you talking about, specific factors that people are speculating might be involved here? I mean...
Possibly. It could be pollutants in the environment. It could be dietary or lifestyle issues. There could be a host of issues that are environmental, that are part of industrialized society, that are accounting for this steadily increasing prevalence of brain disease with age.
So in other words, it might simply not be the older you are, the more likely this disease is to show up, and the only reason that you haven't seen much of it before is because people
So the epidemiologists have presumably controlled for that it does not look, that's a very hard thing to be certain of, but it doesn't look like the increasing incidence of the disease is simply a matter of it's better recognized now. It's not just simply a matter that it seems that there is a bona fide increase in the number of people who are getting it, even taking into account the fact that it's better recognized and diagnosed. I think it's very hard to be certain that that's not the case, but it looks that way.
Okay. The community of aging researchers that you work in, do you sense that there's an overarching, largely agreed upon perspective theory of aging that people are working towards, or is it still rather inchoate and we're still putting the pieces together?
So the basic biologists of who study aging, I think, believe that are focusing on two major pathways, the insulin signaling pathway, for which there's very good evidence in model systems such as worms and flies are involved in the aging process, and sirtuins, for which there's also good evidence in model systems. And those are the two main molecular systems that have emerged, or at least that are characterized. Other molecular aspects of the aging process which are being focused upon are the damage to the genome and to DNA. We study that, which accrues with age and alters the expression of genes. So I would say that the community of aging biologists do have a sort of more coherent focus on a few topics now than they did, let's say, 15, 20 years ago.
Okay.
When the field was much more descriptive.
Harvard, David Sinclair is at Harvard, Lenny Guarenti is at MIT, one of your neighbors, both intimately involved, obviously, with sirtuins. Your take on that? I mean, are you...
Well, I think sirtuins have great promise in the modulation of disease. They have many different effects that all appear to relieve different kinds of abnormalities that occur with aging. Now, there isn't not yet compelling evidence that sirtuins extend normal lifespan in mammalian species. So, for instance, if you overexpress Sirtu, the prototypical sirtuin in yeast, you prolong lifespan, and that and variations on that theme were the initial stimulus to thinking that sirtuins are lifespan modulators. If you overexpress the mammalian analog to SIRT2 called SIRT1 in mice. That doesn't happen. You don't get prolongation of lifespan. You do actually prevent early cell death in mice that are fed a high-fat diet. So the sirtuins can modulate the effects of stress in the environment, it seems, or at least some forms of stress in mice. But whether or not they actually prolong normal lifespan is a separate issue. That said, I think sirtuins, by virtue of their ability to modulate the response to environmental stresses, which we are all exposed to, have enormous promise in the prevention or retardation of a number of disease processes, such as type 2 diabetes, possibly other metabolic disorders as well.
Does that translate into when you get on the plane, for example, does that translate into having a glass of red wine? Is that a practical consequence of the sirtuin research?
Well, you know, there's good evidence that red wine might be efficacious for cardiovascular health, independent of any of the research on sirtuins. There's good epidemiologic evidence. I think resveratrol might contribute to that, but I think there's good evidence that there are many components. Red wine has a huge number of antioxidants and other components that are potentially efficacious. To just say resveratrol is responsible for it all, I think, would be an overstatement at this point. But so the answer to your question is, I think there is good evidence for drinking alcohol in moderation. Many studies suggest that very moderate use of alcohol can cut back on the risk of cardiovascular disease. But you know, interestingly, that doesn't apply only to red wine. It only also applies to some other forms of alcohol. If it's used in great moderation, can reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease.
Okay, well, I know you have to get a flight. I presume you'll have a glass of wine on the plane, and we'll see you next time.
Yes.